good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to our interview series, episode number 285. And I am thrilled, pleased, feel awesome. I don't know how many other words. I couldn't get her to come to the college I was coaching at the time when she was in high school. She's the one that got away, but I got her on the podcast. It is Carrie Amy, the head girls or head women's basketball coach, excuse me, at the University of South Dakota, one of my alma maters, by the way. Did you know that, coach? I've got my master's degree from the University of South Dakota. So
that's fantastic.
Next time you're in the library, look up my master's thesis. It's somewhere in the institution there. So how about that?
I'll do that when I'm bored someday.
You know what it is? You know what my master's thesis was about?
I don't.
Well, obviously you don't, but the recruiting influences of Division I women's basketball players. Yeah. So it is a practical item that you can use to help the Coyote program out, if you will. So that's my contribution. So that's my contribution to my alma mater. Read that, and in 3 years you're going to win a national championship. It's done and over with. So
awesome. Okay. Go Yotes.
Go Yotes. There we go. Before we bring in Coach Amy full time here, we've kind of violated that rule already. Let's talk about our founding sponsor, Cosec Chiropractic, located at 144th and Maple here in Omaha. Coaches, if you or any of your athletes have balanced neck or spinal issues, go see Dr. Kevin, Dr. Heidi, 402-964-0300. Follow us on Twitter at a pen and a napkin. We try to put out daily coaching tidbits on the Twitter handle, so be sure to follow us there. If you're listening, Spotify, iTunes, whatever it may be, first of all, subscribe. Second of all, give us a 5-star review. Third of all, write something nice about the podcast and everything. It helps us move up in the rankings and has, when folks look up coaching basketball podcasts, it helps us out. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Enough of that stuff. Carrie Amy, head women's basketball coach, University of South Dakota. Before we do anything else, I also, as I was getting ready for today, you know what else I stumbled upon, Carrie?
I don't, but I'm ready to hear it.
You're ready to hear it? Did you know you have a Wikipedia page?
I do, really. Yeah. No, I did not know
that. You have a Wikipedia page. This is the official level of fame. If you can get your own Wikipedia, I'm still looking for the Wikipedia page for a pen and a napkin. It's not there yet. I haven't seen it anyway, but you have a Wikipedia page. So there you go. Speaking of arriving, Carrie, we've known each other a long time, literally. I'll let her tell the story and everything. I'm going to let her kind of cook here. Coach, tell us, for those of us that don't know about you, about your background, tell us about your basketball journey, how you ended up at the University of South Dakota.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in South Central Nebraska, Edgar, Nebraska, tiny town, part of the Sandy Creek, Consolidated School District. And, you know, started, I think, about second grade. And to be fair, I was not very good when I was super young. Didn't really come from a basketball family by any means, but had some really good youth coaches that kind of fostered my love for the game and taught fundamentals. And, you know, we had a good little program and kind of learned how to win pretty young. And then obviously went to Sandy Creek and played for Russ Neimeyer and was fortunate to be a part of the dynasty. I think that was a 10 out of 12 state championship run there for him at that time. And, you know, I was lucky to be at the right place at the right time with really good people. Really talented basketball players and really learned how to win there. And then, you know, had an opportunity to go play in college. And you were actually part of that recruiting process. And You know, had some options, several different NAIA options, all pretty much in the GPAC. I knew I wanted to stay kind of close to home. Didn't realize being 35 minutes from home at Hastings was where I would end up, but decided kind of late in the game that that's where I wanted to go. And, you know, was again, really, really fortunate to have good coaches, to have great teammates. You know, we were able to build something pretty special there, being a part of a championship culture and winning a couple national championships. And, you know, that kind of set the course for my career. I went straight from playing to coaching, and Tony Hobson was my college coach and kind of asked me in the spring of my senior year, hey, would you be interested in being a coach for me? We were losing our assistant, and I said, absolutely not. my undergrad was in psychology. I thought I would do something in that field. And, but I, you know, when I was, I'm going to admit, when I was playing, I was pretty locked in on playing and I got great grades, but I wasn't really career focused. I was kind of focused on what I was doing, with our team. And so got done and realized I didn't really have a plan. So I thought, okay, yeah, I'll take up Tony's offer for 1 year until I figure out what I want to do with my life. And about, I don't know, 3 weeks in, I realized like, oh, okay, this is actually a lot of psychology. Mm-hmm. And, kind of was able to put a lot of my passions together into one job, and been doing that ever since. So graduated college in 2004 and been doing this for 21 years now.
Mm-hmm. When do you feel like you said, Tony kind of drug you into this kicking and screaming, our newest category on the podcast, the Karen Self, a pen and a napkin moment. When do you remember, Carrie, the first time where you started, you know, taking pen to paper or pen to napkin or whatever it may be and start drawing out those X's and O's and kind of knew this coaching thing was maybe something for you?
You know, honestly, I actually did that as a player. And I think that's why Tony was like, you know, people around me all the time would say, you're going to be a coach, you know? And I was like, no, I'm not. But, you know, when I was a player in college, it was a little bit crazy, but I would 2 hours before the game, I had this notebook and I would write out, you know, it was my way of preparing, but I would write out, you know, all of the offensive keys and defensive keys. And I would write out the other team's set plays that I knew that might be something that we needed to be ready for. And I would remind myself of our own plays and who we were looking for. And mm-hmm. I mean, my team was like, my teammates were like, you're a nut job. You know, you're crazy. But, you know, I do think that really, it helped me kind of, maximize my abilities. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say I was the most athletic player. I wouldn't say I was, you know, the most skilled player. But I took a lot of pride in being the most prepared player on the floor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I think that was kind of where it started, and everybody around me knew it, but it took me a while to really realize that coaching was an option. I don't know, for some reason, I guess I didn't really think about it being an option for a career, mm-hmm. For me, but, mm-hmm. yeah, I'd say that's kind of where I started being able to, you know, and we my teammates, obviously Elizabeth Herbeck and I, we played high school together and then yep. we played college together. We lived together. So we would take film home. At that time, it was still on the VHS tapes.
Yep.
And we would take the film home and we'd sit down together and talk through like, hey, how are we going to defend this? And, you know, what do you want to do here? And how are we going to get you the ball, Liz, in this situation? You know, so we were kind of doing quite a bit of that. Even as players in college.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, and in all seriousness, when we were recruiting you, I think, and the term didn't come out until later, but you're right that you weren't the most athletic or explosive type of player, But you had what, and it was like Mike and Jamie and I would sit there, what is it? What is it about her? Why do we, and the word would be grit. And I think that would be the best way to describe you as a player. And I know that as a coach, I'm guessing that's probably your greatest strength is just the grit that you bring to each situation. Can you analyze yourself in that way to say, hey, you might be hitting on something there?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, I would agree with that. And I think, all credit to my parents. My parents are gritty. And my dad's the hardest worker I've ever met in my whole life. He was a water well driller for agriculture for almost 50 years at the same company. Just worked his tail off. And I'd have farmers come up to me all the time and tell me, hey, your dad is literally the hardest worker I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. So I just think it was what I was raised in an environment where, you find a way, you don't complain, you work really hard, you keep your head down, you just work for everything you did and
get the job done.
Yeah. And I think I was a little bit maybe ignorant to the fact that like there were limitations, whatever we set out to do in high school, right? We ended up finding a way to get it done. And so when I went to Hastings College, we were actually mediocre. That first year that I played there, I think the year before I got there, we were maybe a little bit above 500. The first year I was there, I think we finished the season like 20-10 or 20-11, something like that. And I remember going into Tony's office and I said, hey, coach, I respect you, but we're not good enough. And I need you to go out and recruit better players or I'm leaving. And he started laughing at me. I was just finished my freshman season. He started laughing at me and he said, well, Carrie, I'm pretty competitive too. And if I don't recruit better players, I'm going to leave. That next year, then we went, I think 34-3 or something like that, and won a national championship. So, I just think it's a mindset. A lot of times people will look at me and, say, well, like that can't be done. And I'm sitting there saying, well, why not? Mm-hmm. Like you just figure it out, find a way, work hard and good things will eventually happen.
Yeah. Well, you talked about your dad and your parents being huge influences. Let's talk a little bit about Tony. And just the obviously not only did you play for him, but you ended up working for him as well, both at Hastings and then you went to Fort Hayes with him as well for a little while, right? Yep. Yeah. So tell us about, his influence on your coaching career.
I would say before Tony, though, let's talk about Russ real quick.
Well, I don't know if I want to talk about Russ. No, I'm just kidding.
I'd say with Russ, the biggest influence that he had on me was understanding that basketball can be two things. It can be really hard work, right? Where you're really grinding to try to accomplish something important. And it can also be a ton of fun. Mm-hmm. The biggest gift that Russ has is his ability to motivate players. He would get you to want to run through a brick wall and you didn't really know why other than he was asking you to do it. So I think, I've been able to take a lot from that. He also obviously created a winning environment. And so being able to take bits and pieces of that, I think, I still carry those with me today. And it's a huge part of how I coach. And Tony was, he had high expectations. He was very, very competitive. I would say the biggest influence he had on me was offensively, he really, really understood how to put players in positions to do what they do well. Mm-hmm. I really, really took a lot from him from the offensive side of the basketball, and just understanding hey, this player is really good at isolation from the middle of the floor. How do we put that player in situations where they're going to be able to do that often? I think just gaining a lot of understanding of trying to take advantage of matchups, trying to take advantage of just the things that players do well within the construct of a team offense are things that he did a really, really great job of. Because defensive side of the ball, obviously that was a huge emphasis for us in high school, full court run and jump,
yep,
press. Yep. We lived and died on defense, so to really have somebody then to learn from on the offensive end of the ball, I felt like I definitely, helped me become a more well-rounded coach.
Mm-hmm. You also have a unique setup where you go to work every day with your husband. I love my wife to death. We are celebrating year 27 of marriage here in a few weeks and that type of thing. But if we had to work together, she'd kill me. And I get why. I understand. I wouldn't want to work with me either. I get it, So how do you guys make it work?
Well, congrats on 27 years. That's a long time. So.
I suckered her into it, I guess, so.
Well, to be honest, I think when we started coaching together back in Kearney, he started on the men's side. I was on the women's side. We started dating, got engaged, and decided to work together because it's really hard to follow two careers in the coaching world, as you might imagine.
Yep.
So, first of all, it takes a person to not have an ego to be able to say, like, hey, I'm going to come to the women's side and work with you. You're already a head coach and I may never be on the men's side. So let's do this thing together. That takes a special person. And so, Devin's, he's an extremely hard worker, but also really humble and just wants to help build a great team. And he doesn't care how we get that done. So I think, it takes a special person for sure. But we were not very good at it to start, I'm going to admit. It's just an interesting process to go through because you're trying to share it. And at the same time, you still gotta have somebody in charge, right? You still gotta, have somebody at the end of the day, make the decisions. And so once we got that kind of figured out, I feel like we've gotten really good at it. And one of the things that helps us is he's really good at things that I'm not very good at. And yep. I'm really good at some of the things that he's not as good at. So we kind of figured out, hey, operate within your strengths and stay in your lane. And, he doesn't need to be micromanaged. So that helps as well. And, we've really made it work. He does a lot of our recruiting. And I think it really helps us in the sense of he understands me really well. So he knows, what kind of players, will fit within our program and what kind of players and personalities fit best with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's a huge advantage for us.
Yeah.
Because you don't always have that kind of continuity with your recruiting coordinator or your staff and who they're recruiting.
Well, if he doesn't do what you ask him to do, he just, doesn't get supper tonight. And that's the way it works.
That's exactly true. That happy, happy wife, happy life thing. He says that pretty often. So he says, how does this work? You get to be the boss at work and at home. Like, well, yeah.
You've got the perfect system.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I'm pretty fortunate, I feel like.
Coaching today is, let's be honest, it's harder than it ever has been. And the demands on us, the things that coaches are asked to do, the lengths that we are supposed to go to be the best coach that we can be, it's becoming more and more difficult. A lot of coaches come into their coaching career and they feel really, really good about their X's and O's knowledge, the technical aspects of the game. And I was very much the same way. That's what I thought coaching was all about, but it's so much more than that. It's about being, especially at the high school level, and you can say the same thing at the college level or even the professional level, it's about being the CEO of your program. folks, I think I've put together maybe the best thing I've ever done. And that is my third book coming out here this fall, 365 Days of Hoops, a one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO. And what I was able to do was to put together 365 separate concepts of what it takes to become a basketball CEO of your program. This is all divided into basically 10 different areas: book studies, coach studies, X's and O's. So you got to know what the 2-3 zone defense is all about. Zone sets, defensive tenets, whatever that may be. Culture, building a great culture at your program. Your game day execution. What are you doing on a game day on a daily basis when you're going into competitions? Skill development. Personal development, finding time for you, taking a vacation, handling failure, creating your resume, practice, how to build a great practice, how to become a great practice coach, off-season workout ideas, and miscellaneous coaching topics. 365 Days of Hoops has those 10 topics subdivided into 365 different things that you need to do as a basketball coach. At the end of every page, there is space to journal, to write, to X's and O's, everything that you need to do to take that topic, to think about it, and to think about what you are going to do. This is going to be available early this fall. Don't have an exact date yet, but I wanted to put that out there for you coaches so that you know what's coming out here. It's going to be a really, really good thing for you. One thought a day, take 3 to 5 minutes every day to think about it. And by the time you're done with this book, you are going to be really, really be prepared to be a basketball CEO of your program. So keep your eye out on it for 365 Days Hoops, a one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO, coming this fall from A Pen and a Napkin. Let's talk about, you've done things the right way. You've done things the traditional way, so to speak, I guess we would say, Carrie, where you started off as a, NAIA assistant and then Division II assistant and then NAIA and then Division II and then working your way up the ranks here at the Division I level. What have you seen as you've made your coaching journey? What has been the changes, the different things that you've seen as you've quote unquote moved up levels? And that journey isn't for everybody. There's people that are okay with just being a junior college coach for 25 years or being a Division I assistant with no desire of being a head coach for 25 years or whatever their journey is, but what have you seen as you've changed different levels? What's been some of the similarities and the differences as you've made these steps in your career?
Yeah, it's crazy when you say it like that, how many different places I've been, and like you said, just kind of climbing the ladder slowly, and not necessarily a typical path for a Division I coach, but I'm actually really grateful that I started at the level that I started at, because when you're an NAIA coach, you're doing everything. Mm-hmm. When I was an assistant at Hastings, I was also one of the dorm parents. So I was in charge of 85 to 90 freshmen and sophomore girls in a dorm. I lived in that facility. And I kind of coached it was kind of like the other part of my job, So, and then when I was a head coach at Hastings, right? Like I'm driving the vans, I'm scheduling for a JV and a varsity. I'm teaching class. I'm advising students. I'm, you're doing about 25 different things. And it, to me, it helps kind of grow a few things. One, your work ethic, right? Two, it gives you just a more versatile skill set. Mm-hmm. And then I think three, those opportunities that I had in those situations with smaller schools, you have way more involvement with like the administrative side and the academic side of the institution. And I think it gave me a broader perspective of how everything works. Yeah. Right.
So how now I have
such a deeper understanding of what's happening on the other side of campus and how that impacts us in athletics. So really grateful for those opportunities. But I would say the biggest thing is at every level, you realize, I think basketball is basketball, right? Yep. And there's great coaching at every level. In fact, some of the best coaches I coached against were at the NAI level and the Division II level. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's a lot of great coaches at the Division I level as well. But like you said, not everybody is that's a great coach is going to end up at the Division I level for whatever reason. So the basketball is basketball, and so that's probably what gave me the confidence to be able to continue to pursue just trying to grow and be better. Honestly, I never had a ultimate goal of becoming a Division I basketball coach. Mm-hmm. My mindset was always, I want to be great right where I'm at.
Yeah.
And I want to be, you know, build a great team and a great program, and whatever happens. If great opportunities come, I'll look at them, but I'm not trying to get the next job. I'm just trying to be great where I'm at. So I think some of the differences are at the NAI level, size, right? Like, that's changed a little bit over time for several reasons. I think one, volleyball has become, if we compare it to 25 years ago when I was playing basketball, right? Like,
yeah,
it was not that abnormal to have some 6'2", 6'3", post players at the NAI level. I played with one. I played against several.
Yep.
Now, I think just getting size, especially like, let's say in the GPAC and NAIA, is a little bit more of a challenge, right? So yep. Now you're playing with maybe 5'10 to 6 foot post players instead of 6'2", 6'3" post players, right? So lots of full court pressing. The game is way faster. There's way more possessions in an NAIA game, I think, than there is in a lot of Division II and Division I basketball games. Mm-hmm. And then I think when we moved to Division II, you know, we kind of, when we first took over at Fort Hays and I was an assistant for Tony, we were thinking, man, why isn't anybody pressing? Let's try to use our full court kind of run and jump stuff that we used at Hastings. And we tried it a little bit and it was not very effective. Mm-hmm. Because of the skill level, but also the size, you know, it was just a lot harder to be able to be effective in doing that. And so we realized quickly that unless we were going to get the best athletes out of any of our opponents, that was going to be a little bit tricky. So that it just changed a little bit. Right. And so, I think everywhere I've been, regardless of level, When you take over a program, I think one of the first things you've got to start to analyze is okay, what is it going to take to win at this level and in this league?
Yeah. Yep.
Right? Because yeah. To be successful in the MIAA looked a lot different than what it looked like to be successful in the GPAC.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got to the MIAA in Division II, it was, you know, if you were going to beat Central Missouri and Emporia, you better have some size and you better have some physicality and your wings better be long. And so we had to change the way we recruited. Mm-hmm. You know, and then Division I think, you know, I don't think it's huge overall stuff, but I think you see differences in, like, the skill level, right? Like, there's those, the best players on every team. I mean, they are like really difficult to defend.
Yeah.
So you've got to come up with maybe some different defensive schemes and some things that, you know, you maybe haven't done in the past to be able to slow down a kid that can just flat out score it. And not that there aren't any of those players at the NAIA level. I just think there's maybe a few more of them, right? Mm-hmm. Pop up at the Division I level. But when it comes to great coaching, when it comes to, you know, X's and O's, all those sort of things, I mean, basketball is basketball. Yeah. And, you know, there's high school coaches that are brilliant all the way up through the Division I level. There's some really, really good coaches, really good players. And there's probably more similarities at each of those levels than you might think.
Yeah. You referenced, you know, the changing players a little bit there and movement. You know, what's, you know, when you're at Sandy Creek, you know, here's the group that we're going to have. And obviously you're in a different dynamic. You know, this year we were talking before we even started, you said 13 new players in the program. Yeah. So what's it like coaching with that? I mean, obviously, like when you're a high school coach or when you've got the program established, you're still going to have turnover every year. But it just seems like there's so, with the transfer portal and different things like that, more and more turnover every year. How do you try and build that continuity within your programs?
Yeah, I think that's the challenge now, right? Is if you've got a super complicated system that's going to take kids 2, 3, 4 years to be able to get good at, that might be a challenge now, right? Mm-hmm. At the collegiate level.
Yep.
In high school, obviously, and high school's changing too. I mean, I think kids are moving around a little bit more than they have in the past. But, you know, in high school, in our system at Sandy Creek, it was like, here's the system, right? And you're going to figure out how to fit within that system, right?
Yeah.
As a player. And I think now, and you're kind of molded into that system. I think now one of the things that we've actually been pretty good at even before the transfer portal and some of those things is like, and I kind of learned this from Tony, is like, you gotta be a little bit flexible offensively, in saying, okay, what are our players really good at, rather than what do I want to run? Right. And yep. And I'm going to try to get our players to do these things well. It's got to be more of what do our players do well and how can we, you know, put them in situations where they can do what they do well, because you might not have that player for 5 years. You know, you might only like, you know, there's several players on our team that we're only going to have for 1 year because they're transfer kids. You know, so how do we maximize their potential and help them be successful? You're not going to take a fourth or fifth year kid and change their whole game, you know, in the 6 months that are leading up to the season.
Yep.
You're just not. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's a little bit of a different mindset, right? It's like I said, that flexibility, that ability to kind of like evaluate your team and then say, okay, how do we this team in situations where they can play well together and do what they do well.
Yep. So you got this challenge here. You're year one. You had a great player in Grace Larkins, averaged 20 some points a game. Team success, probably not what you wanted it to be, of course. So what are the, what's kind of some of the plans as you're transforming the program into your vision of what you want the program to look like here? You know, big step here from year one to year two. So what's been some of the things that you and Devin have been looking at and the rest of the staff have been looking at to move the program more in the direction that you would like to move it in?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I think if you look kind of at every program, I think this is about my fourth been part of about 4 or 5 rebuilds, you mm-hmm. know? So, every first year is a challenge, right? Cause you have a group that you're just trying to figure out, okay, how can I take this group and again, be flexible, right? And figure out, what can we do to try to help this team. Right. And then mm-hmm. once you get into year two, it's a little bit, you got more of your fingerprint on it. Right. And so, what we're trying to do is get back a little bit more to the things that we really believe in, right? That we believe are like the things that help teams win, right? Like, yep. You know, and so defending and rebounding are two things that we really, really care about, because we feel like those are the controllables. For whatever reason, I've had really good players that can really score the basketball that for whatever reason on some given day cannot put the ball in the basket, right? But defensively, you know, that's effort, attention to detail, that's being in the right spots and habits and grit and those kind of things. And so defending and rebounding, you know, have really been a huge emphasis. And you know, obviously you want to recruit players that can score it, but you also got to recruit some players that are two-way players, right? Mm-hmm. That play both sides of the ball and that help us be able to get stops and finish possessions with rebounds. And then it's for us, the first and most important thing is the culture, right? And for me, culture is people. It's not a place, right? And so we're going to build a culture with our recruiting.
Yeah.
So it's people, right? And so people ask me that all the time, like, how do you build a great culture? And I'm like, well, we start with who we recruit, right? We're going to add players that fit and kind of possess some of those traits we value and that we feel like help us build a winning environment.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, yeah, you know, we had to go out and get, you know, 13 new players. And, you know, we feel like we were able to add players that are going to help us kind of, you know, get the thing going in the right direction. Obviously there's great tradition here. There's great fan base. People really care and support. And so for us, it's getting going, building that kind of winning culture. And then from there, right, it's if you can have some success, right, it helps with recruiting, right? It's yep. It's like you
it all works
you bring
together.
Great, yes, you bring great people, help those people develop into great players, and then those great people go recruit other great people, and you just kind of build it. You know, you build some momentum and then it starts to work itself out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that organic part of it where you build one piece after another piece and yeah, it's just a cyclical thing. And we, you know, when I was coaching collegiately, especially, but even at the high school level, the more you can get your players to sell the program and say that this is the right place to be, this is the good things about this, this is what's great about Coach Amy or Coach Plum or whomever it may be, the easier it is for the program to sell itself. Because now you're not selling the program, it's the people who are just as even more, if not more invested in the program than you are, that are selling it to the next generation of players that you're trying to get involved with the program.
Absolutely. 100%. We say that all the time. Our players are our best recruiters.
Mm-hmm.
They absolutely are. And so, you know, our job is to make sure that our players are accomplishing their goals. They're developing as players and as people, and they're enjoying their experience. Right. And if we can do those things right, they're going to be our best recruiters. Mm-hmm. No question.
Coach, let's talk a little John Wooden at this point. What do you think about that, Carrie? All right. Wooden, a lifetime of observations here. We pick a quote every week out of that here. So I've got a John Wooden quote of the day for you. I'm going to read it to you. I'll give you a little bit to digest it here and tell me what you think, and we'll kind of chop it up a little bit. So sound good, Carrie? All right. So from page 16 of Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations, the John Wooden quote of the day is, "It has been said that you will be hurt occasionally if you trust too much. This may be true, but you will live in torment if you do not trust enough. Trusting is part of our higher nature. Doubting is a lower instinct. The latter is easy to do, the former more difficult, but so much more rewarding." Youth sports today has become a billion-dollar industry nationwide, and grassroots basketball has been at the epicenter of this explosion. These days, players, parents, and handlers chase the almighty scholarship, NIL deals, and branding creation. However, there is still one place where basketball coaches and players come to develop their games without the fanfare and adulation of recruiting gurus, next-level evaluations, and social media highlight reels. It's not a basketball camp, it's a basketball school. Snow Valley Basketball School started as the brainchild of Herb Livesey, who, as a young adult, was inspired by the great Bob Cousy to start his own basketball camp. Starting in 1961 at Snow Valley Ski Resort, east of Los Angeles before moving to Westmont College in Santa Barbara. Livesey's school was a place for the game's greatest coaches to teach the game throughout the 1970s and 80s. Two Iowans, Don Showalter and Jerry Slicus, adopted Livesey's curriculum, bringing the school to Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa in 1994. This summer will be a celebration of its 30th anniversary of Snow Valley in the Hawkeye State. Here, over 1,400 campers will start each day before dawn and end after the sun goes down. Snow Valley Basketball School is America's longest continuously running basketball camp. It's where players come to learn and coaches come to teach. For those that come there every summer, it is the home to the Last of the Cowboys. The Last of the Cowboys, the story of Snow Valley Basketball School, will be available on Amazon on July 1st, 2025. Paperback copies will be available for $17.99, while Kindle copies will be available for pre-order for $9.99. Get to know the story of America's longest continuous basketball camp.
It's like deep.
Yeah, hey.
Deep stuff.
That's a Briarcliff education talking there. You know, deep stuff, deep thoughts with Briarcliff College.
Deep thoughts with Marty.
Yeah, there you go. No, what do you think?
That's good. That's really good, and I totally agree. In fact, one of our core values of our program is trust. Mm-hmm. I think if you don't have trust, you don't have anything, right? And I do think that sometimes we have a hesitancy to be worried about, well, what if I trust and somebody breaks that trust, or it doesn't work out, or whatever, fill in the blank, right? Mm-hmm. But I feel like when players, and I'm just talking program specific here, like when everybody's willing to kind of go all in and say, okay, hey, I'm going to be trustworthy and trust willing, and I'm going to really, you know, trust the people, the process. You can't really get to maximal potential for a group of people.
Yeah. Well, and it's trust where you've got to, when you're recruiting players, you've got to, okay, hey, this kid may break my heart, but I'm going to trust them. I'm going to do everything I can to try to get him to our school. But that trust has got to go in both directions. They've got to trust you that if you say in the recruiting process, as an example, hey, Mary, we're going to do this and this for you, and we're going to try and get you set up as best we can for this future career that you want to pursue, yada, yada, yada. You know, you've got to establish that. And then I think the biggest thing, and this is when trust is broken, is when you don't follow through with things that you promise. And I don't know about you, but when I was coaching, I didn't want to make a bunch of promises to a bunch of players because I didn't want to promise something that I knew it couldn't be 99% certain I would deliver. It had to be 100% certain I could deliver on that promise, because I didn't want to make a promise and then not be able to deliver on it, and then that trust is broken.
For sure. 100%. And I think that's, you know, if you think about college and even high school, I mean, I know there's some recruiting that happens, but like
just a little. Just a little.
Maybe more than a little these days. But you know, one of the things that I think, like you just hit the nail on the head of, like, if you say in the recruiting process, right, that it's going to be one way, and then a player shows up and it's different than that, immediately you've broken that trust, right? So we talk about to our coaching staff all the time, like, whatever it is that this experience is actually going to be, that's what we're selling. Mm-hmm. Because when they show up, I want them to feel like, okay, this is exactly what they said it was going to be, right? And I just think that establishes from the very get-go, right, a strong level of, okay, I can trust these people. And they said it was going to be this way. You know, we're not trying to sell Disney World, and then they get here and they're like, well, where's Disney World? Right. Like, so, and I know that that's not necessarily the case for everywhere. I know a lot of times people try to paint a, a really great picture to you know, get somebody to commit.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I like you said, it really sets you up for
a lot of future problems.
Just, yes. Yep. 100%.
Yeah.
You know, so it's once it's in the recruiting process, it's once they get here, it's the whole way through. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about trust is it takes forever to build, and it takes one situation to break it.
Yep. Yep. And it's, yeah, it is a fragile thing, you know. And it's, you know, you had mentioned that you were a psychology major, and, you know, those are the things that I would think that you would realize is, you know, you gotta, sometimes when we get into coaching, and we're going to talk X's and O's here in just a second, but it's those things off the floor or those interactive things that sometimes the best coaches are the best at is managing personalities, managing emotions, managing situations, and getting people to work together in that vein. And I'm not saying that X's and O's aren't important or schemes or anything like that, but man, that's just such a huge part of it.
For sure. Especially with women, right? Like, the chemistry piece of being a part of a team is as important as the skill piece.
Uh-huh.
A group of people, you know, the better they get along, the more they care about each other, typically the better they play together. Right. And so, I think it takes a ton of work to try to help them, you know, establish relationships in a way where they're not necessarily always all going to be best friends,
yeah,
but they develop a level of respect and trust for each other where, you know, they can get on the floor together, and instead of battling each other, they're battling their opponent, right? To become the best team they can be and to accomplish something that they couldn't do by themselves.
Yeah. Carrie, let's jump into, speaking of schemes and X's and O's, after we say this other stuff is more important, now let's talk about, we're going to talk about some basketball stuff here. You're going to be speaking at the Nebraska Coaches Clinic here. And when are the exact dates for that? I don't even have that written down.
That's a great question, Coach.
Yeah.
it's later in July. It's the 20th.
Okay.
July 23rd. Okay. I'll be at the Nebraska
Coaches. So by the time folks hear this, if you want to go see Coach Amy in action, go to the Nebraska Coaches Association Clinic on July 23rd, and that'll be next week by the time folks hear this. She's going to be talking about full court and half court defense, so we're not going to talk about that here. We are going to talk about some of her other philosophies, and let's start here. Let's start with transition offense. Obviously, like you said, you played in a high-tempo system at Sandy Creek with Russ, and moving the ball and getting it out and going. So, Kara, I'm just going to kind of let you go here, let you talk. As I tell all the guests, if I feel the need to interrupt, I will try to do so as politely as I can. But at this point, I'm just going to kind of turn it over to you and tell us a lot about your philosophy when it comes to transition offense and getting the ball up the floor quickly and attacking.
Sounds good. Yeah. I mean, obviously the goal for us offensive transition wise is, can we put pressure on the defense to get set? You know, I think transition defense is a really, really difficult thing to get organized, right? To sprint back, get organized, make sure you got the ball under control, make sure you're protecting the basket, all those kind of things. So those first 10 seconds for us, if we can steal easy opportunities because we put a ton of pressure on that defense over and over and over throughout the course of the game, we feel like we're going to be able to, you know, to score some points in every game. You know, now there's some really good transition defenses out there, especially in higher level basketball. But our goal is to obviously finish a possession, right? Mm-hmm. So rebounding is a huge part of transition offense. If you can't rebound, you can't play on offense. You know, so getting stops and live ball possessions where we can play quick is super important. So our point guards are a huge part of our transition offense. I want the ball in our point guard's hands because they're our best decision makers. Doesn't mean that we'll never push with our fours or our wings, but our point guards, I really, really want to get the ball out quick with an outlet and look to get early advances. And that's something that, you know, way back in the day with Russ, he really ingrained in that to me. If I can get the ball up the floor quickly on a pass to my wings that are running wide and running hard, that advance pass puts even more pressure on that defense because the ball is now moving ahead quicker than it could off the dribble. So we're going to go wings run wide. PG gets the ball out, looking to get early advances. We're going to have a rim runner. So our four or five is going to run hard to the front of the rim. And we really think that that rim runner, they're not always going to get the ball, but they put a lot of pressure on the rim. So there's got to be a defender that covers that rim runner, which allows sometimes those advance passes to happen a little bit more often. And we're looking to score in those first 10 seconds. So RPGs, if they don't have an advance pass, they're looking to attack the rails. Because we feel like that's a difficult area to defend one-on-one, are the rail attacks. Obviously looking to maybe get an early entry into that rim runner. But those first 10 seconds, we're really racing the ball. You know, being a former point guard, I think limiting turnovers is extremely important too. So can we put pressure on the defense and value the ball?
Yeah. Like that's the magic elixir right there. You know?
Yep. We want to do both. So
how do you do it, coach?
Well, I think it comes in practice. You know, honestly, I think it's giving your point guards a little bit of freedom in practice to try to make some passes. You know, like make those over the top passes to the rim runner so they can kind of learn, hey, can I deliver this pass? How far away can I deliver this pass? You know, so we allow our players to make some mistakes in practice, but we also teach those mistakes, right? Like,
yeah,
we talk through, okay, hey, that didn't work out so well. Why is that? What do you need to do differently? Right. And let them kind of work some of those things out. I think so many times in practice, we as coaches, we overreact to mistakes or we, you know, don't allow for mistakes in practice.
Yeah.
And so we can never really figure out what that limit is. You know, even as a player, I used to have some players that really ran on the floor well when I was at Hastings. And I had to get to a point where I could take one dribble and throw a one-handed pass. And Tony looked at me one day and he said, Carrie, I hate that pass, but you deliver it pretty well. So here's the deal. I'm going to let you make that pass. But if you throw it to the bleachers or to the wall, I'm going to get pissed at you. Yeah. And it was just like a mutual understanding that like, look, like I'm going to let you make that pass, but you got to own it and you got to be accountable for it. Mm-hmm. And what he was saying to me essentially is I trust you, right? And we talked about earlier the importance of trust. So I think in practice, we teach what we want in transition. We allow for mistakes. We grow in our trust for each other, players and coaches together. And we figure out, okay, what's the fastest pace we can play at and still be under control and still limit those turnovers.
That's the mindset you have to have. And you were talking about mistakes earlier, Carrie, and the thing that popped into my mind was, and I love what you said, where you're saying, you know, we've got to allow our players to experiment. We've got to allow them to make mistakes. And there's correcting mistakes, but every once in a while you say, hey, that's a great mistake. I see what you were seeing right there. I don't want you to discourage you from doing that. Keep trying to do that. I think it's going to work if we keep working on it. Kind of like what you kind of talked about with Tony there too. And I think that's a key part of it as well, is sometimes you need to find the positives and the mistakes that your players make. And sometimes you need to have a more forward-thinking attitude of, that's a great mistake. I love what you did there. Keep trying to make that happen. I think it's going to work for us.
Provide some level of encouragement, you know, and like you said, I think right now, especially, players are so scared to make mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. And they're expected to be perfect all the time. And, you know, I move on from mistakes way easier than they do, right? So as a coach, I've had to develop this mindset of like, how do I help them move on to the next play and drop the mistake and start to think about solutions?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's another thing. What's the solution? How do we make this better? And that's our role as well. So if you, I'm going to throw this out here at you. If you were stuck on a desert island and the basketball coaches or the basketball gods said, coach, here's your team. We're going to allow you to run one transition offense drill from here to the end of eternity, but you only get one drill that you can do for your transition offense. What's it going to be, Carrie?
Ooh, that's a good question. That's a really good question. I think if I was a younger coach, I would have said, you know, some sort of breakdown drill. I think as I've gotten older, I realize that the more game-like the drill is, the more it translates to games, mm-hmm. right? And so, I think for us, it's a 5-on-5 drill that we'll do. We put, depending on what day, you know, we might put 12 seconds on the clock, right? And we're trying to execute and get a shot in 12 seconds, right? With a live defense, mm-hmm. right? So, because I think it's realistic, right?
Yeah.
And you can run all the 5-on-0, you know, 5 trips, blah, 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 that you want to do. And I think that's great when you're learning it. But when you're really, really trying to work on, can we actually get this done, right? I think it needs to be fun.
Yep. Coaches have really enjoyed the opening tip newsletter that has been coming out from A Pen and a Napkin here for almost a year now. Every 2 weeks, on the 1st and the 15th of every month, you're going to get a newsletter with an article, a podcast, an extra, a bonus podcast. You're going to get some coaching videos on there. You're going to get some book recommendations, a lot of different things that are coming out here with the opening tip newsletter. It's really driven towards a little bit more of a personal written form of what we do here at A Pen and a Napkin, which of course is to help coaches get better, to hone their craft. And so I use a lot of my own personal experiences. We use other people's personal experiences. We try to go into the lab with coaches. We try to get into the nuts and bolts, a little bit more of a visual compilation of things that we do here at A Pen and a Napkin. So if you haven't subscribed to the opening tip newsletter, you need to do so now. Go to Substack.com, find the opening tip newsletter and subscribe to it. Or if you find it on Twitter here, go to it, check it out, subscribe to it. It's going to be a really, really good thing for you to check out. So check out the opening tip newsletter on Substack from A Pen and a Napkin. Let's talk maybe the greatest question that every coach has in America. Coach, how do we get our players to communicate better on the floor?
You know, I think way back at the beginning of this conversation, you were talking about, you know, holding players accountable or holding people accountable, right? And creating an environment that you want, right? I think we were actually talking about the classroom.
Yep. Off air, we were talking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it's the same thing when it comes to communication. I can't tell you how many high school games I go to and I'm sitting there watching the game and there's not a single kid on the floor really saying anything. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think it's for us, what we do is we force them to talk in everything. So if we're doing stretching at the beginning of the practice, right? And we've got one person saying what we're doing. The rest of our team is required to echo that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We are going to say what we do in everything, right? So if we're sprinting to a screen, they have to say, like, as they're sprinting to the screen, they have to say they're set when they pop their feet, right? They have to say, you know, everything that they're doing, just to get them to speak out loud, right? Yeah. To get that processing from going in their brain to out of their mouth. And the only way that you do that is by actually requiring talking.
Yeah.
And we'll redo a drill. Just like if you don't get a goal or you whatever, right? We have all these standards for, hey, you got to make this many shots for this drill, or you got to, you know, whatever. It's like, no, if you are not doing what we're supposed to be doing from a communication standpoint, then we're not, you know, we didn't win the drill. So we just, I mean, it has to be a point of emphasis, right? Like, but you have to tell them what to say. I think that's the biggest mistake we make as coaches, is we're just like, hey, just talk through it, right?
Yeah.
Well, like, they don't know what to say, right? So just by giving them phrases or keywords or things that they have to say, you're empowering them to know what to say.
Yeah.
So I think it's really, really hard to be learning a skill and coming up with your own vocabulary while you're learning a skill.
Yeah.
And say, as like a 14-year-old, right? Like, yep. But if you tell me exactly what I'm supposed to be saying as I'm learning that skill, it's reinforcing the learning of the skill. And it's also helping me develop the habit of communicating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, when you are coming into a situation, you're coming in here at South Dakota, your former coach may have called it this, but we're going to call it this, and we're going to be consistent. And our staff is, you know, this type of screen. You may call it a curl cut, but we're going to call it a MacGuffin cut or whatever. I couldn't think of anything better to say, but you to have that common verbiage and then to emphasize that verbiage. And you need to do that, like, at that, you know, a lot of the coaches that are going to be listening to this, Carrie, are high school coaches. I think it's important that you establish that vocabulary as early as you can within your program. It needs to start at the junior high level at the very latest, and if not earlier. You know, our man-to-man is red. And we're going to call it red. So don't call it, hey, get into man. Call it red, so that when they get to high school, we just say, hey, we're in our red defense. They know exactly what it is. You know, all of those things on down the line. And having that consistent vocabulary and have everybody saying the same thing in the same way, coaches, players, outside staff, whatever it may be, it's so vital, because then it gives you more time to teach. And maybe you only save 2 minutes a day, but that's 2 minutes times 100 practices. That's 200 minutes. That's three extra practices that you get because of that.
Yeah, totally agree. And to me, communication is, like, especially let's say defensively, right? Like, communication is like one of our huge keys on whether or not we're any good at it, right? Mm-hmm. So you can drill all these different things, but if you're players aren't communicating, it's not going to matter. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
And so I think so many times, especially with high school coaches, I know you have such a limited amount of time with your players,
yep,
but you know, the things that are really, really important, right, are the things that you need to spend time on.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think we shortcut those things that are really, really important. And then we don't understand why we're not getting the result, right? Our philosophy when we teach things or to decide what are the things that we're going to work on, you know, like if we say, okay, we're going to work on defense, there's 9,000 things that could be important on defense, right?
Yeah.
For us, we want to be really, really good at the things we have to do a lot.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So for us, like, let's say, for example, closeouts. Defensive closeouts are something we do multiple times in every possession, So we're going to spend a ton of time, you know, whether it's 5 to 10 minutes every single day on something that we know is like one of the main keys that's going to make our defense great. Right.
Yeah.
So it's no different when it, when you're talking about communication. Like you said, you have to establish a language. You know, you can't, you know, it wouldn't go very well if you had a team and you had a couple people that spoke French and a couple of people speak English and Spanish and, you know, like, but that's kind of what, as coaches, like we've got 9 different languages going on or no language, just mute. Right. And we're wondering why it's not working. Why? And we're frustrated. Right. It's like, you got to all be speaking the same language and it's got to be spoken out loud. You can't be like this expectation that we're able to read each other's minds.
Yeah. Well, and I think the biggest thing that you're talking about, coach, is, you know, your priorities. What are you going to prioritize? And, you know, communication needs to be at the top of that list. I think most people would agree with that, but you can't do everything. It's got to be prioritized. You got to figure out what's going to be the most important, like for you. And we were the same way. Closeouts, you know, we did closeouts every day for 5 or 10 minutes, not only for defensive purposes, but, you know, as an example, you're going to be well scouted and you're going to have players to make plays. The only way they learn how to make plays is by making plays in practice. So it works both ways, offensively and defensively. Your priorities can be whatever they want to be, but you can only prioritize so much and you've got to figure out what they are and you've got to make them consistent the entire time.
100%.
Let's finish up here, Carrie. Let's talk a little bit about administration. You know, you know, most of your experience in your professional career, all of your experience in your professional career has been working with collegiate administrators and athletic directors and SIDs and different things like that. But we all have to work with administrators and other people around us. What are some words of advice that you have for coaches to make their relationships with their administrators, with the people who are above them? How can they clear up those lines of communication? Just make that relationship as positive as they possibly can.
Yeah. I think the first thing that I think a lot of times coaches, you know, they think, well, I'm just going to stay in my lane and only worry about my program and not worry about, you know, the big picture. And I think that's such a big mistake. You know, I think it's really, really important if you're a coach, a head coach of a program, whether it's high school or college, to try to understand how everything works from a big picture perspective. Because I think, you know, it helps you have perspective about, you know, Tony said this to me right away when I first was about to become a head coach. He said, Carrie, never forget this. Only you are the only person that's going to advocate for your program. It's your responsibility. No one else is going to advocate for your program. It's your job to do that. You know, and I really took that to heart, but I also realized that in order to advocate for my program, it was helpful for me to understand the big picture so that I could advocate in a way where I was protecting my program, but also being a team player.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think it's really, really important that your administration understands that you're not just out for your own success, but you care about the other programs in your school, in your institutions, you know, their success as well. Right. And so I think that perspective has helped me a ton because there's been times where there's battles that I won't budge on. And then there's been times where there's battles that I say, you know what, is this the most important battle for me? Or can I give some ground here and, you know, let the volleyball team have X, Y, and Z or whatever, right? And I think your administrators appreciate your being a team player in that way, you know? So I just think sometimes we stick our head in the sand and try to just focus on our own program and silo ourselves. And you know, I think it creates a lot of challenges that aren't necessary.
Yeah. Well, we preach to our players that they need to be great teammates, but you bring up such a great point that as a head coach, you've got to be a great teammate to the volleyball coach, to the softball coach, to the men's basketball coach in your situation, whatever it may be. You can't just have everything that's good for the Coyote women's basketball program and you can't give anywhere along the way. You know, you've got to be okay. And one of the things that I found in my career is when you don't complain very much or you're not knocking on the door of the AD's office asking for this or that or the other thing, when you, and this is, you know, a Coach Meyerism, when you budget your bitches, when you do go in and say, hey, this isn't right with this coach, or, hey, I really need this, and you sincerely mean it, and you're logical about it, and you're not asking for the moon and the stars and everything in between, that works a heck of a lot better than being that person that's always just in there, just chirping, chirping, chirping away. That's what 100%. I found.
If you have a consistent, you know, if you stay consistent in what you need, you know, I think one of the administrators that I worked for said, one of the things I love about you, Gary, is when you come in here, it's not a different priority every time you come in here. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got one need. It's the most important priority for you right now. And it helps us focus on helping you get what you need. You know, because if you come in here and one day it's you need this and the next day it's you need something different, and then it's like we don't know how to help.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're exactly right. And if you want that cooperation, you've also got to give cooperation as well. And yeah, it just can't, as much as we would like for everything to be perfect for us, it can't be perfect for us. You're going to have to work your way through some things, and that requires that communication and willingness to give and take a little bit. So
100%. I mean, like you said, it's what we're asking of our players is the same thing we need to, you know, to live by. You know, we're not going to get everything we want. We can't make all of our players happy all the time.
Yeah.
You know, our administrator isn't going to be able to make us happy all the time.
Yep.
So it's being able to team player, I think, is probably the most important thing.
Yep.
In fact, in every interview I've had in my last three or four jobs, that's one of the big questions is, what would your coworkers, like, what would be words to describe you? Like, what would your coworkers, what words would they use to describe you? Because mm-hmm. they want to know if you're a good teammate.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of talented people out there, but if you're not a good teammate, we'll just get somebody, maybe they're 1% less talented than you, but if they're 100% a better teammate than you, I mean, we would do the same thing as coaches, right, Carrie?
Absolutely. Yep. No question.
Yep. What a great morning. Carrie Amy, head women's basketball coach. I couldn't land her as a recruit 25, 26 years ago, but we got her on the podcast here today, and I've only been asking her to come on since, I don't know, September or so, but we got it taken care of. Carrie, so it's awesome to reconnect with you here this morning. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a ton of fun. Thanks for having me on, and appreciate the way that you've been helping coaches with your podcast and all the other ways that you continue to invest in coaches. It's an awesome resource, and you've been a ball coach for a long, long time. So appreciate everything that you do for the game.
Yeah, seasoned and experienced is the phrase we use here on A Pen and a Napkin. And you're starting to get into that realm a little bit as well. See, I checked your Wikipedia page and found that out. See, oh, full circle. There it is. And I'm going to drop the mic on that one. So, hey, real quick, Carrie, if people want to know more about you, want to know more about the Coyote program, how can they find out?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you can get on our website, goyotes.com, follow us on our Twitter, Instagram pages. Our Coyote women's basketball one is a little bit better than my personal one. I've never been a very good tweeter or poster of personal stuff, but we got some great stuff on our team pages for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, again, great having you on here. Carrie, if you could hold the line here just a second, I'm going to wrap up a couple of things. Again, Carrie Amy, head women's basketball coach, South Dakota, University of South Dakota. And she, you know, I say this not, like I said, I've known her for a long time, but she is one of the rising stars in the women's game. She's going to continue to do terrific things at South Dakota, and she's going to get that program going in the direction that everybody wants to see it going in. So great stuff from Carrie this morning. Again, we want to thank our founding sponsor, COSAC Chiropractic. Check us out on Twitter, @APennandANapkin. We got a bunch of good things going on here. If you're listening, again, subscribe, download, rate, review, do all these great things that helps us out. Questions, comments, suggestions, ideas, email me APennandANapkin@gmail.com. We got more and more great stuff coming around here. Hoops 365, 1 year guide to becoming a basketball CEO. We're getting closer and closer to finalizing some stuff on that. Hopefully to have that out here early this fall. So coaches, be ready for that stuff. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.